it's recording.
Okay, and so make sure to mic your first question.
Okay. What's your name?
My name's Bob Cook, or Robert is the official.
Would you prefer to be called Robert?
No, I prefer to be called Bob. My signature is Robert M.
Okay. So what title would you like Harrison to identify you as in the story?
I guess you would say, well, I'm retired vet center team leader, and veteran of the Vietnam War.
Sounds good.
I don't have a big deal about titles.
So you served in Vietnam. Would you like to say what province or provinces you served in?
I served in two corps in Pleiku, and I think that was the province in Pleiku, and with the 71st Back Hospital, which was part of the 55th Med Group. I'll get close to you.
Sorry.
And primarily that's where I served, even though at times I had to go in other places in the Central Highlands like An Ke and Quy Nhon. The headquarters of 55th Med Group was in Quy Nhon, and that's how I got there taking the graduate record exam, believe it or not.
What's that?
Well, as going to graduate school after coming out of Vietnam, you had to take GRE. And the only place they gave it was a morning in spring of 1968. It must have been in February, because the night I was down there, I flew down on a Friday to take the exam on Friday, on Saturday morning, and our hospital got mortared that night. And I got a bunch of people gave me the business that I was gone when they were being mortared.
Wow.
Not meanwhile, but. And the funny thing about it is it's about a two-hour, as I remember, two- or three-hour exam. And then they rushed me out of the, it was done, and put me on a plane so I could get back to the 71st thing.
Can I ask him one question?
Sure.
Why was it that, were you drafted to serve in the war, or did you...
No, I was explaining to Harrison before. No, I was, I went to a land grant college and did the first 2 years of ROTC, which everybody had to, and then in, they convinced me, because I was a poor college student, the advantage of going to advanced ROTC, which at that point in time was $50 a month, which doesn't seem like much now, but $50 a month was big, considering that I paid out-of-state tuition at the University of Illinois in the early 60s, out-of-state was $290, which could be paid in three installments, which I did.
Wow.
Unbelievable. Considering when I write a check for my son going to school. But anyway, I don't know whether I answered your question completely, but that's how and then once you go into advanced ROTC, they send you during your junior year to go to boot camp or what they call Army orientation kind of thing, where essentially what they do is they send you to a Army base. In this case, it was Fort Riley, where you'd spend 8 weeks. The first 6 weeks is it's like being in boot camp, because the whole concept is, since you're going to become an officer, is to acquaint you with what it's like to be an enlisted man. So they cut all your hair off and you do PT and you do all the kinds of things they would do going through basic training. You know, you go out and you go through rifle training and all that kind of stuff. But the last 2 weeks of it is where they switch you to doing actually tactics, infantry tactics, as an infantry officer kind of circumstance. And basically, it's all kind of on the job kind of thing, where they, at one point in time, you may be leading the patrol or the platoon you get killed, quote. And another, because all of the people who are participating in this are going to be future officers.
So you were attached to, was it a medical evac unit?
Yeah. I was at the 71st Evac Hospital. I was at that time, by that time, I had got a branch transfer from the infantry to Medical Service Corps. I'm probably here today because that branch transfer went through. Because I graduated as an infantry officer, and generally as an infantry officer, you have to serve 2 years in your branch before they allow you to do a transfer. But at that point in time, I went into graduate school immediately afterwards and had gotten a master's in counseling, and that was one of the reasons that, and this is 1966, at this point in time, there is the biggest mask, and everybody and their brother was going to Vietnam, no matter what we tried to do to avoid it, if you are already in the military. So the question then, and I requested a branch transfer, and I got a branch transfer. So I feel very fortunate about that, because the kill rate of infantry lieutenants is very high in Vietnam. In fact, it's pretty high in every war, as a matter of fact.
How old were you when you, I guess, entered Vietnam?
I was older than the normal. When I went to Vietnam, I was 26 and turned 27 in Vietnam, which is unusual because the average age of most Vietnam veterans were 18 or 19, say. And probably because of the extended time I took to get my undergraduate and graduate degree. So I didn't, since I was already in the war, I mean, I didn't have the experience of some friends of mine who got drafted just because of the fact that they had a very low number, and as a result of it, got drafted.
See. I'm gonna go check on Coyote. Are you okay?
All right. Yeah.
I'll be back in 15 minutes.
All right.
You're doing great, Harrison. So are you, Bob.
Yeah. Right.
I should probably turn it this way. So you were, I guess, you weren't drafted, so you don't really. I guess you have kind of a lesser heard experience of, because most of the time when we hear accounts of Vietnam, they're like, oh, my friends were all drafted, so either I was drafted or I signed up so I could be with my friends. That's the normal thing you kind of hear.
That's true. But here's the thing you got to recognize in some instance. When I, even in 1963, decided on advanced ROTC, there were probably 11 branches that I could have chosen. And you have to ask, why would anyone who's in college, with at least two years of college, choose to go into infantry? Well, I had friends in the infantry. That's the reason I chose infantry, not thinking of the consequences of being in the infantry in that circumstances later, you know. So, I mean, it's not, so in retrospect, in some ways, that's how I got into infantry. I just was fortunate down the line of having done certain things and lucked out and got a branch transfer. Otherwise, I would have been serving in Vietnam in the infantry. And even when I went there, I had a secondary, what they call MOS, Military Occupational Specialty. I had two of them, one for personnel officer, but I still had my 3,500 infantry MOS. And, you know, there always was a concern that if, even though I had this primary MOS in Medical Service Corps, if I got assigned to an infantry battalion, which was still a possibility, they would have looked at my background and I could have still ended up in the field as an infantry officer. So I didn't, so I was lucky.
Yeah. What were your experiences with, I guess, the people who were living in Vietnam who are not combatants?
Being the adjutant at the hospital, we had Vietnamese working at the hospital, and my job was to go out and recruit or hire. I don't know whether hire would be the word, but yeah, I mean, those were the kind of, so we had people coming in and out of our hospital who worked there every day doing certain kinds of what would be more menial tasks in that circumstances, which they were happy to have because they got paid in dollars and was worth more than the piazzas or the, I don't think that's the word, peso. No, that's not right. Boy. I don't even remember the Vietnamese currency now, but the point being, they got they earned a lot in that sense, like that. See, so it was probably a kind of I wouldn't say it was equal kind of circumstances. So you didn't get a chance to talk on that basis, and otherwise. I didn't have a lot of contact with Vietnamese in the field or the. There was always the joke that we had. Our barber was Viet Cong. Well, who knows whether that was true or not. But in those times, like I was there in Tet of 68 and all hell broke loose for, 2.5 weeks. And this was in last of January into February. And that particular time was when the Vietnamese, or the NVA and VC showed very to anyone whose eyes were open that we had no chance of winning this war because what they were able to do during Tet kind of sense like that. But at that time, they took control of many of the cities in the country, and we had people who, because they actually came into and took control or partial control of Pleiku, which wasn't too far away from us, we had Red Cross and some other folks that were stationed who came to our hospital as a result of that. And, you know, I mean, you could watch the planes drive them out of Pleiku City kind of thing like that. So it was, anyway.
You said you had friends in the infantry at the time. Do you know what happened to them, if you would like to speak about that?
That's a good question. I don't, I mean, the interestingly enough, because you look back at your, one of the friends in mine in ROTC was killed in Vietnam as a helicopter pilot, who went to the same high school I did down in Champaign-Urbana, or Champaign, Illinois. I've looked, you know, occasionally you pull out that yearbook you had from summer camp and you look at, and I've wondered, you know, how many of these guys actually served in Vietnam and how many survived, and I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. So were you were there for Tet Offensive was 68, right?
Yeah, I was there from, I was there from essentially September 1st, 1967 to a year later, which is like August 30th, 1968. And Tet took place about midway through my year there.
Mm-hmm. So what was going home like?
Going home was a mixed bag in some ways, because in the last when you got short in Vietnam, usually you made a little going home stick, what we had, you know, and it was a short timer stick is what they called it, see. And so as you got closer and closer to derosing, as that was what they called when you left, you were anxiously wanting to get out of there and not be, the fear everyone had was that you would be killed walking to the plane, you know, which did happen to folks who were at, so I mean that kind of sense. So there was always, and there's always the issue of, you know, you serve a year with me, but people were coming and going all the time, but there's still a lot of people that you served a year with, and you're leaving them behind, and so there's a little, yes, there are new people coming in at circumstances like that, but there's a little sense of, it's kind of like a team, and you're leaving the team, and you want to leave the you want to get out, you want to go home, you want it to be, yet you have a little bit of feeling bad because you're leaving, you know, the job's not finished, even though in our case, we weren't killing people, but we were in a an organization that was keeping people alive and moving them out in that sense. So you had a sense of you doing something valuable. So that's so. And then going home, everybody held their breath until the plane actually was in the air and relaxed, because it's not just. I mean, you're in a. A Boeing, a big plane full of GIs coming back from the war in all different branches. They weren't just, you know, they were a mixed bag of kind of people. But in our case, it was mostly Army. And there might have been some Marines with us, too, in that sense like that going back. But and then when we got back, I didn't run into... When we landed, it was in Seattle. I mean, there may have been some protesters, but I don't have any memory of where other guys had walked through and people supposedly have spit on them. That didn't happen to me. But as soon as you got on stateside, you generally took off your uniform and put on civvies. So when going back home, you wouldn't have to face the potential anti-war issues or anti-war folks like that. Didn't matter whether you may have felt anti-war or not, you just didn't want to be faced, because even by that time of late 68, the war wasn't terribly popular. There was a fairly strong anti-war movement going, and one of the criticisms of the American public in some sense is that they couldn't distinguish the war from the warrior. Now, later on, but for the first, I don't know, probably the first 30 years after, maybe not quite, 25 years or so after that, they were still, Vietnam vets were getting a bad rap for having served, see.
So you were an officer in Vietnam. That's something we generally don't really get, I guess, as much. It's not given as much attention to as, I guess, the common soldier.
Sure. Yeah, I think so. And for one instance is the officers and me. Typically, when they talk about the war and they talk about the 18 and 19-year-old soldiers serving, which is that they're not really talking about officers, because in general, officers would have been, they were more likely, if they came my way, they would have been 21 or 22 up to my age kind of circumstances, or even if they went in and went through officer candidate school, they were most likely would have been older than a 18 or 19-year-old, a year or so, but not just so. They would have been older in that kind of circumstances. So they didn't, they wasn't easily, and they were recruited under that circumstances, and they were recruited that way. That's why they generally, you got to officer candidate school if you were drafted and you were a college guy kind of thing. I mean, you had some background that they thought, or some experience that they thought would benefit in a leadership position. Or you had something that, however they assessed it, they thought it would be, you had some kind of leadership qualities, say. That's not always true, but that's. But anyway.
So, did you ever have to, in the face of potentially losing an area, did you have to quickly move a medical facility? You never had that experience?
No, we didn't have that experience. because the war wasn't exactly like that. It didn't mean that you weren't at risk, because during Tet, we got mortared, and rocketed attacks. The first time we got rocketed, it was based on the fact that evidently our ground troops had overrun a VC hospital, and it was sort of payback. And that was... And that didn't do much damage to the hospital. The one that we got the most damage was the one that I wasn't there, is because we don't know what precipitated that. But it was during that period of time that I had gone to take that graduate record exam. But we got we took a direct hit on one of the wards, but we were fortunate that the rocket went off in the top of the building rather than going down in there. I mean, there was enough notice, or there was enough and this was an orthopedic ward, so you had guys that were in their legs were up in their arms and at circumstances like that. For people who are ambulatory, they got them, had time enough to get them down under their beds where there were bomb boxes with sand in them so they could get between them. And they, or they'd throw a mattress over someone they couldn't move. And there probably may have only been two or three like that. But by the fact that it went off in the there, when you saw it afterwards, half of the building, there was shrapnel all the way around kind of circumstances. But no one was killed, with one exception. And no U.S. troop was killed, but there was a Vietnamese, whether it was a soldier or a Vietnamese, being treated there, and that person panicked, got up during the act and tried to run out and got killed as a result of the flying shrapnel. So, I mean, it's fortunate in that kind of circumstances that did. I mean, we'd big, humongous hole where one hit in before headquarters, and we lost a one of our medical supply buildings, but fortunately we had only one for the amount of damage, which was shocking or surprising that we didn't get worse than that. I mean, a week later we got another rocket attack, and it only hit along the side of the compound. But one of the guys who was up on guard duty, a piece of shrapnel came through the only area it could, caught him right here. And that time shows the ironies in some sense. You get a major hit like that, nobody but one person. And that person, if he'd stayed in place, would not have been killed. And here's a guy doing his duty and just weird about how those things happen. A piece of shrapnel came through, and where it got him, it killed him. So, but to answer your question back to it, we didn't have to move. In general, just because of the whole helicopter kind of command, but it didn't mean that wherever you were at, there were eight nurses killed in the war. There were other folks killed as a result of in other evac hospitals throughout, from the same, usually it was incoming kind of circumstances. So, but not, it's not like you weren't at risk in, as compared to being out in the field where somebody was wanting to shoot you kind of circumstances. Yeah.
Were you technically considered a non-combatant?
No. Because we had a non-combatant would probably be someone that's not armed. As a medical service corps, there was only seven of us, and we were the officer of the guard, and we put guards out, and we had bases, and they had to go out. And when you were on as the AOD, a minister officer of the day, which meant that you ran guard duty from about 10 at night to 6 in the morning. So every 2 hours you had to go out and check on, be sure your guards were in the different spaces around there were not asleep, kind of thing. And so, I mean, particularly way in the back, which was back where supply and that stuff was, you drove a Jeep and you made as much noise as possible, because if the guys were asleep, you wanted them to wake up and not shoot you by example, say, in that sense like that. So, but the answer is, I had two weapons, and so when I was on guard duty that one day a week, I had my .45 and I had even a small carbine that I had bought off the, so I was prepared to, if I needed to, if for instance somebody had infiltrated our base, which wouldn't have been him, would have been possible because we weren't guarded by infantry troops. We were guarded by troops who were medics, and in that circumstances like that, and at best they had minimal training in that circumstances like that. So that was always that was a concern, but as a result, I think the greatest danger to us was when we got mortared or that kind of sense like that. But from looking in the back, I could tell you they could have come through one side of our base, walked back through and out the other side, and we would have never known it. So that was, you didn't think much about that though. Otherwise, you would go crazy. And it's like the guys, we had an MSC officer who was going home during Tet. I mean, soon after Tet. He spent the last 2 weeks in country in a bunker. Well, maybe I would have done the same thing if I had been in his shoes. I don't know. But anyway, so we weren't a non-combatant, but we weren't. We weren't combat troops. We were prepared, those of us in security kind of positions were prepared to use our weapons if they were needed to.
So you mentioned that there was a Vietnamese killed in the mortar attack.
Yeah.
That raised a question in my mind. You treated, I guess, prisoners of war then, too?
We didn't there. POWs down in Quy Nhon, there were two different hospitals. And one, the 67th of VAC, treated, that's where most POWs were taken, kind of thing that were treated. We treated... we may have treated somebody who, sometimes we treated civilians that got hurt as, normally there was a Vietnamese hospital down the road too, but if you had the choice of being treated at the Vietnamese versus the American hospital, you would opt for the American hospital because we had better facilities, better doctors, better treatment kind of things. Now, I can't remember exactly whether you had to have some connection to get in there, because we did treat at different times, but most often the people we treated were civilians that got injured, probably as a result of U.S. Actions of some sort, you know, and as a result, we treated them, but we didn't, if they brought a POW in our district, they would have sent them down to the 67th, where there, that got complicated because, you know, you also had, you had the struggle with maybe treating VC prisoners the NVA, North Vietnamese Army prisoners, but at the same time, there's an interrogation unit right attached to the hospital whose job is trying to get them to turn and give information away, while on the other side of it, in the hospital, the medical people are, you know, like they are, they're not trying to make a distinction if somebody's hurt. They're trying to treat them and heal them, see. So it's a little bit of that got to be a touchy situation at times.
What would you, I guess, how would you, what would you say the quality of the equipment you were using to treat people was?
We probably had the best, the latest and the best hospital treatment equipment available at that time in the 60s. I mean, we had a we had a normal evac hospital that had a TOA, which means which should have 200 personnel. We had 300 people assigned to it. We had medical specialties there that normally would not have been in an evac hospital. I mean, people doing brain surgery, and I mean, doing all kinds of specialists in that sense doing it. So another reason that American troops survived at the rate higher than they had done in any previous war was the quality of the medical services they received, and that and they were available to them. Not only getting out there, but they got the best medical service possible, and at the same time then got moved to Japan or back to the States kind of circumstances. So on that, I would say without a question, and if you were Vietnamese, had any glimmer of that, you would say, take me to the American hospital.
I'm struggling to think of any other questions to ask. Is there anything you would like to say as, I guess, we kind of wrap this up?
What would I say? I think that... the guys who served in Vietnam, many did not, I mean, there are a lot of folks who went to Vietnam who were not, quote, believers in the war, but they served honorably there and did their jobs and didn't, I mean, the struggle was, yeah, I mean, even when I went there, you know, I was questioning the war, but I thought, hey, it's an American, if we wouldn't be there if it wasn't for a purpose, until Tet came along and made it pretty clear that throughout all that kind of stuff like that. But the in general, and I would say without a question, the American fighting person did their job in Vietnam and did the best job they could, whether they were totally 100% a believer in it. It was kind of like you were there. If you were in the combat zone, there was no politics in the combat zone. I mean, if out in the field there is. I mean, they could argue in the hospital there are politics, and we had doctors arguing whether it was right to treat a Vietnamese or not. One saying they should, one saying not. Out in the field, guys worked together and as a team and served in that kind of capacity, knowing that what they did out there was critical in keeping each other alive, say. They didn't, this is tough. They didn't deserve the treatment they got coming home. That was... And it took a long time for to rectify that. That's all. That's basically. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was Bob Cook, a Vietnam veteran.
That's perfect. I know that school's over now. One of the thing I always ask people, just hit the stop button.